these huge giants, you know, walking amidst the clouds or what have you.
Oh, this compels me.
Metal music. It's hard to write a song in an entire minor key and talk about, you know, nice things. Heavier, obviously, doomier at times.
When he came over, and God, when he started singing, bloody hell. I couldn't believe what's coming out of his little body.
Somebody said, anyone got an idea what we should do as a stage set? Jesus and Stonehenge. So there's this dwarf who comes out, and he's walking across the top of this Stonehenge.
Pure spell.
Black Shadow!
Welcome to Sabbath Bloody Podcast, featuring Tony Iommi. A sabography for the masses. It's time to get into that era of Black Sabbath here. We're deep into the void now, for myself anyway. Hopefully we don't get lost in all this messy timeline that I have in front of me here today. And Jesus, lads, there is some really dark stuff in here too. I had no idea about all this drama going on behind the scenes, but it's really made this LP a more interesting listen for me at least. So strap in, because there's a lot of setup in this one today. It's the call of the seven star. By late 1984, though, Sabbath as we knew it had pretty much dissolved. The remaining core members were Tony, Geezer, and I'll throw Jeff Nichols in there for good measure. Also Bill Ward, to a lesser extent, as he popped in for the new singer searches, but then lost interest quickly. Actually, you know what? Let's just play catch up here for a moment. Break down each of the originals' situations leading into 1985. First, Nibia, I guess. Bill was geared up at the prospect of a full Sabbath reunion with Ozzy. He started hanging around Geezer and Tony after Ian Gillan and Bev Bevan had left the camp, so he was obviously down for the next project. And getting Ozzy into talks was proving to be quite difficult, though, with the Arden family feud still cooking hot, and his solo career was in better shape than the current state of Sabs, even. So eventually, Bill Ward just retreated back to America, where he unfortunately sank into his addictions pretty hard again. And here's a quote from Bill, actually, that appeared in Mick Wall's book, digging out some shit on Bill Ward here that he would have been getting into around that time, begging on the sidewalks of Huntington Beach, California. He's living on the streets. Okay, so I was panhandling for nickels and dimes just to get what I call a short dog. A short dog is a strong, small drink, so it could be a small bottle of or a shot of something. I was doing that in 1983, after I'd been born again. There was no money. I had no money. I blew whatever earnings I got. So that's Bill there. And it seems our man Geezer was also very much sticking around, waiting for that Aussie thing to happen. Although he and Tony didn't seem too interested in working on material together anymore. In his spare time, Geezer was actually pushing towards doing his own stuff, away from Tony's wheelhouse. He even assembled a little jam band of sorts, did some clubs around the UK under the moniker of the Geezer Butler Band, playing a few Sabbath tracks here and there too, but mostly his own material. And let's not forget, Geezer is the most prolific writer of the four, so he was never going to just sit on his ass while all this shit was stalling out. We'll have to dive into his solo work too when we get into like the 90s and 2000s when he really starts releasing this material. In 1984, though, he was more or less just doing it for fun, like just to get the music out and not being pulled into any big fucking world tours or anything. A lot of the songs that Geezer writes around this time are brought to the Sabs in later incarnations, actually, so it's important to make note that he's keeping on. And Geezer also kind of makes it apparent to Tony through this that if he's going to play Sabbath stuff again, it would have to be with Ozzy. And I think Tony understood that deal too. So all signs were pointing towards a proper reunion being the only way to push the Sabbath train forward. As for Tony and Jeff Nichols, as he just kind of hovers around Tony and sniffs up any leftover lines from the mirror, let's be honest. Tony's activity around 84, 85 is much more storied, I suppose that's the word. His personal life becomes kind of filled with turmoil and insanity. High levels of cocaine intake were the order of the day for our riff lord around this time, so we'll actually come back to his dark state in detail as we get into the album that we're covering today more. However, to move forward to the first Sabs event that I want to touch on today, it should be noted that sometime in the mid-80s, Tony Iommi officially bought the rights to the name Black Sabbath. And given the timing, the other guys didn't think much of it. But it becomes a pretty big deal for us and the material we'll be covering going forward here in the official catalog of Black Sabbath. And I'm not privy to the contracts of the various members up until that point, but I've heard that the four originals kind of just co-owned the Black Sabbath name and kind of split everything four ways. And there probably wasn't any consideration to Tony solely owning that from this point forward, as he had always kind of taken the lead anyway. It certainly wasn't done in a sneaky way, at least from what I gather. It was almost just, he was the last one left who gave a fuck about the legacy of Sabbath and the name, so he protected it legally. And also, apparently, they still owed Vertigo a couple more Black Sabbath branded offerings. So he more or less inherited that with the namesake. And in early summer of 1985, it was announced that the original lineup, Tony Iommi, Geezer Butler, Bill Ward, and yes, even the man, Ozzy fucking Osbourne, would be performing together for what would become one of the biggest music events in history, really. Live Aid, the OG Sab 4, were ripping a hungover three-song set at 10 in the fucking morning. Yeah, that's the money slot there, right? Together for the first time since 1978, televised live to the world. The band, as it appeared on TV, was billed as Black Sabbath featuring Ozzy Osbourne. And this was apparently at the request of Don Arden, who attempted to shut down the whole thing when he caught wind of it, serving Ozzy a writ days before his appearance, forbidding him to perform under the name Black Sabbath. The whole Live Aid appearance was really the product of Sharon hustling to get Ozzy onto the Live Aid bill. She didn't have the pull to get him on solo, but a Sabbath reunion was given a slot, naturally. And with the lads all wanting to give it a go anyway, for the crack of playing with Ozzy once again, they went ahead, despite the Don's cease and desist notice. Don't get too excited by this. It wasn't a badass breaking away from the label. The album we're covering today does not have the four original Brummy lads back together again. This was a one-night-only event. After the Live Aid, our favorite four Brummies hung up their pointy guitars, and it was back to their fractured existence. Okay, so drink time here for me, the first interlude. I need Jeff Nichols to come in and fucking score my drink interludes, right? With some ominous keyboards. Make this a proper 80s Sabbath listen for you. Now then, I'm going to concentrate on only the main players now for the Seventh Star album. That reunion was just kind of an anomaly, really. But now, let's go deep into it with our sole Sabbath survivor, the keeper of the brand, our riff lord, Mr. Tony Iommi. And I need to lead this next, more in-depth Tony recap section with a disclaimer, I think, because things are going to get a little serious here, folks. But I want to at least include reference to this shit moving forward, because everything is going to be Tony focused for the next few albums. And getting a glimpse into his personal life really adds some levels to the dark and melodic output that is the Seventh Star. Hell, that is Sabbath from this point forward. But we're good to go in deep, right? You guys are up for this. We're all fucking adults. We can deal with some heavy shit here and understand that some of these claims could have been false. They could have been true. I just want to make sure, because I know there are a lot of hardcore fucking Tony Iommi worshippers who just follow the show, and it seems the only time that I get what might be considered hate mail is when I say something critical about our riff lord. So I'm going to just say right now that there are some unsavory moments touched on here in regards to Mr. Iommi's lifestyle in 84, 85. And I don't want to gloss over some of these vile allegations that have been made here about his actions around the time, so fair warning to you guys. Personally, I'm able to separate the riffs from the man, and I'll always love Tony's guitar work. I also don't know how much of this shit is being sensationalized and what have you, but, well, here. I'll just get into it, because it's out there, and this would factor heavily into the Seventh Star album conception and songwriting process. So, back on the Born Again tour, I had mentioned that Sabbath brought along former Runaways guitarist Lita Ford with her new solo outfit at the time. Early on in the tour, too, for some European dates. In Lita Ford's book, which I actually read recently, it's called Living Like a Runaway. I urge you to check it out, too. It's a fun read. Lita recalls her band's Sabbath support slot starting in Germany on the Born Again cycles. Or at least that's when she says that she first met Tony and Ian and Geezer together. So that would have been around September of 83 by my tour schedule printout that I have here. Yes, I'm old school. I have printouts here, people. Now, Lita herself was a big-time Iommi worshipper, and any great guitarist rightfully should be. apparently her and Tony had hooked up while on tour. And I'm not trying to TMZ this shit today. This is just for context. But Iommi was also married at the time of that tour. In fact, his wife would have just recently delivered Tony's only child, also named Tony, but with an I, Tony Marie. Not cool, man, but just setting the scene here as it was. Who knows what the marriage was like, and maybe it was better that he wasn't around by the sounds of these next allegations. Eventually, Tony divorces his wife, and his cocaine eyes quickly shift over to his road piece, Lita Ford. I'll try to reserve my comments here and just read the interview from Lita Ford. You can make your own assumptions, and no need for me to take the piss out of any of this either, because these are some serious allegations, and stuff like this should just be brought to light and not turned a blind eye to. I don't want to hear any people writing in now saying she's full of shit and she's trying to sell books. That's not adding to this discussion at all. Here's the quote, take from what you will. Lita on her relationship with Tony Iommi. She says, he was taking mass quantities of drugs like you wouldn't fucking believe, on an Elvis Presley level. Jars and jars of downers. He would buy hundreds of dollars worth of cocaine on a daily basis. There are different kinds of abuse, and people need to realize that. There's sexual abuse, there's mental and emotional abuse, where people really say horrible things to you, and then there's physical abuse, when someone turns around and just hits you. Tony was physically abusive. He was not verbally abusive or sexually abusive. He was just physically abusive. I'm not making any of this up. I couldn't possibly make up a story like I did. I'm not that good of a liar. He had choked me out unconscious. True story, like it or not. Okay, so that, of course, was from an interview where she was questioned about her book. I thought that one was a little less sensationalized than her book is at times. She spends a good couple of chapters, actually, really documenting the progress of that abusive relationship. And I think it's very brave of her to be so candid about it. Gives you a well-rounded view of it in the book, as opposed to your bullshit clickbait articles that spawned off of it on Twitter and the likes. And Iommi fanboys, again, just make sure that you worship the riffs. That's fine. But don't ever turn a blind eye to these kind of allegations because you like the way the fucking guy plays guitar. That's just ignorant and stupid, right? So in the sense of what we're trying to document here in Sabbath Bloody Podcast, let's stay on track. Tony was becoming quite paranoid as well, becoming a bit of a reclusive and pushing people away, really sinking into his addictions while writing the music that we'll cover today. The only ones who really stood by him were, of course, Lita Ford, who seems to be more or less entrapped by him at that point, but also Don Arden, the Don, is still holding him under contracts as an asset, despite the rest of Sabbath moving on with their lives. And of course, his mini-me, Jeff Nichols. Tony and Jeff were writing a lot together at the time, actually, both material specifically for Tony's own solo record, as well as stuff for Lita. They had a batch of bluesy songs and an album tentatively titled The Bride Wore Black that Tony was going to helm for her. And there's a studio version of The Thrill Is Gone, a cover of the song by B.B. King that the two recorded, with Lita's band backing them. I'm not sure if that was intended to be on the Bride Wore Black album that they speak of, but you can hear by the production that it's right in that wheelhouse that the tracks we get on 7-Star are. Tony and Lita even did a few appearances on MTV together, including a live performance, Guitar Great Show, from the New Jersey Capitol Theater that was broadcast on MTV in a cut-up form. This was November of 1985, and you can check it out on YouTube. The guitar wanking is at its finest here, but you all know me when it comes to showy guitar bullshit. I don't care for it, but go check it out for yourself. There's also a first-hand account of the event in Lita's book, which I think is worth reading before you watch it. Certainly brought the performance to another level of interest for me. But sticking with the material being written, by 1985, Tony and Jeff were getting full-on into it. Eventually, Tony's new fiancé wasn't even allowed to partake in any of the process. Even on one occasion, Tony says that he locked her out of their home while he and Jeff were getting inspired, working on material. But the final straw in the relationship, ultimately ending too, was when Tony invited her band to help him round out his new material. Drummer Eric Singer and bassist Gordon Copley. Which is presented as this huge dick move, but in all fairness, these are fucking musicians for hire anyway. Like, Lita didn't own them or anything. It wasn't like they were her band that she came up with either. Like, Tony didn't ask fucking Joan Jett to come in and lay tracks on the album. I don't think it was as much of a power move as they say, but still, I mean, he should have asked her if it was cool. I'm just saying, I don't get why this is the final straw for Lita. I mean, come on, there's claims that Tony apparently tried to drop a chair on her head or something while he was coked out, and she stayed with him after that, but I think that's more grounds for dismissal than jamming with your shitty fucking touring musicians. Just my opinion, but... And besides, Copley goes right back to touring with Lita when she left, so it's really only Eric who stays on with Tony. And that pretty much wraps up Lita and Tony for us. She literally leaves Tony while he heads into the studio and starts laying down the 7-star LP proper. Tony quickly brings in a new bass player too, Dave the Beast Spitz. Okay. More beer. Let's get into the album proper here. Shit, dude. This episode brought to you by Drama. And we haven't even brought in our new singer yet. For this batch of songs, Tony had initially written songs that didn't sound anything like Black Sabbath. And that was intentional in order to expand his horizons. And he more or less ends up with a batch of kind of half-cooked songs. Heavy on the keys, of course, since he's conceived them with Jeff. And there's also a lot of bluesy jams. So it's like one foot firmly planted in that traditional blues rock that we know Sabbath is all about. And then the other slipping into the mainstream like bullshit that was all the rage in the early 80s. So still aiming for the MTV crowd and Sunset Strip action. There's even a big old sappy power ballad just begging for Michael Bolton to come back and sing on. However, the original plan was to have an all-star lineup of guest vocalists. Bring these mediocre jams to another level. You get your Robert Plant, your Halford, David Coverdale, and others were mentioned. But the logistics of tracking down the singers and getting them into the studio proved to be impossible. And when I read that that was the plan, and then I listened to the tracks again with that in mind, it kind of makes sense to me. Iommi's all-star concept obviously didn't pan out, so Tony and the band decided to addition some more young lads. Some unknowns to kind of take these rough ideas and work with them. So back to the LA Hair Farms they went. Enter a singer by the name of Jeff Feinholt. And this guy becomes some proper Sabbath lore, much like Donato and Keel, but another fucking level, because this one is a stage 5 clinger. The general consensus is that Feinholt wasn't really part of the band, and he just kind of auditioned. And there's some demos floating about of the 7-star material that's said to be Feinholt, and it's confirmed that some of it is, but shit, man. All these 80s Hair Farm singers sound and look alike, so they might have lumped in some other audition tapes that were floating around when whoever the bootlegger was stole from the studio. They're all just rough audition-like recordings for the most part, but definitely the 7-star material. I've been trying to figure out their origins, but it's near impossible with this bootleg shit and false claims being made. Even any Feinholt interviews that I find, he's obviously blowing his contributions way out of proportion to benefit his current agendas. But either way, there's a lot of early versions of the title track in there, and the vocal tracks that are on there you can barely call singing. It's like Ozzy's scratch tracks had more feel than these ones. There's a bunch of takes of No Stranger to Love as well, all claiming to be Feinholt. Turned Stone, Danger Zone, Heart Like a Wheel, they're also in this compilation. But and really the only ones not demoed in this batch from the album are Angry Heart and In Memory, so that might give you an idea of the order that the songs were conceived, maybe. But this Jeff Feinholt character, though, he used his time working with Tony Iommi as a launch pad for a heavy-handed televangelist campaign shortly after, getting tons of exposure by claiming to have been forced into Satan worship with Black Sabbath and had seen the light. Hallelujah, that kind of shit, right? But the fact is, even if he was with Tony Iommi and co. for a hot minute, this was not Black Sabbath. The material that they were working on here was intended to be Tony Iommi's solo project. He said that time and time again. So fuck you, Feinholt. You're never in the Sabbath, you Bible-thumping counterfeit. But I mean, come on, trying to use Sabbath's good name to give cred to your born-again image, for shame. It's so hacky, too, if you actually know what Sabbath is about. And at the time, too, Iommi also started working with producer Jeff Glicksman, whom Feinholt claims to have brought into the through his connections, an American producer who's known for his work with the band Kansas. And Glicksman also did Paul Stanley's album when Kiss broke off and did their 4 solo projects there in the 70s. So anyway, Glicksman had a decent output of polished mainstream rock behind him coming into working with Iommi. And by Feinholt's claims, Glicksman apparently threw him under the bus right away and suggested that Glenn Hughes take his place moving forward. Although I don't know if I believe that. Because I think Hughes and Iommi would have crossed paths over the years and would have definitely been one of Tony's targets for the All-Star album. I bet it was more like Tony contacted him to sing on a track or two, and simultaneously Feinholt was hanging around. And then once he heard the voice of rock in action, they decided to go with him, do the whole fucking thing, scrap the multi-singer concept, ditch Feinholt without any hesitation. Anyway, here's a little clip of Glenn Hughes himself talking about what he brought to the table for the Seventh Star.
We're into this very sort of classic rock melodic thing with extremely heavy riffs. The difference between, I guess, myself and Ozzy or Dio is that I wanted a different spin on what Tony was writing on the music, rather than maybe singing in a aggressive voice. I wanted it to spin off into something a little bit more melodic and soulful. So here we have what I consider to be a very melodic album.
The lineup for Tony's big solo record has been assembled here, and it was Jeff Glicksman as producer, Glenn Hughes on vocals, Tony Iommi guitar, Jeff Nichols tickling the ivories, Dave the Beast Spitz on bass, and Eric Singer on drums. God damn, the amount of cocaine it must have taken to fuel that crowd would be unbelievable. I couldn't fathom the height of the snowdrifts in that studio. The master sessions took place in Cherokee Studios, California. And with that, let's get to the tracks, because the power of the sniff compels them.
Power of the riff compels me.
Won't you listen?
There's our old friend Ben breaking the silence of this podcast so far. From the Sterling Sound on YouTube, playing us into this batch of songs for today. He doesn't actually cover many of the songs from this album on his channel, just the A-side. This one is straight up power metal, right? But there is a working demo kind of bed track out there for In For The Kill, just bass and drums up front. And Spitz is a fucking beast, man. He has that pick attack down, really takes off while Tony is more or less keeping the same riff going. Okay, so in my opinion, regardless of if this whole batch of songs was intended to be Black Sabbath or not, it's more the production on this album that's worlds apart from any previous Black Sabbath release. Everything is way overproduced. They crush out all of the nuances of the bass and drums with reverb and all that shit. And it makes it sound even like it's not Iommi riffing to me. Things are clearer than the Born Again album, sure. I mean, compared to Born Again, the production on Seven Stars like goddamn Abbey Road, but it's still very of its time. I can get behind the latter half of the album more, actually, because like from the Seventh Star forward, really, it gets into like a heavy blues kind of world. But even those songs are kind of sunk, unfortunately, by the vocals, which really sinks the whole album for me. I mean, I love Glenn Hughes, huge fan of him, but he puts this smooth vocal line throughout that pretty much kills the first half of the record. And his harmonies, ugh, they're just not subtle at all. I guess this is the first Sabbath album that really does a large amount of vocal overdubbing. Maybe that's what's jarring me. Like, Ian Gillan kept it pretty much one track. Dio overdubbed, but he was masterful at it, so you didn't notice. And Ozzy, well, he's fucking Ozzy. I don't know, some people might love that super harmonized, layered vocal stuff. To me, it just sounds generic. What's that? I need to view it as a Iommi solo project, do I? Is that what you're screaming at your iPhone now? That's what it's intended to be, man. If you just forget that it literally says Black Sabbath on the cover, it's an amazing record. So many people have said that to me, just to view it as an Iommi solo project, and then it's a great rock record. But no, it's a fucking Black Sabbath record. And honestly, if it said Tony Iommi solo project, or I guess Iommi not featuring Black Sabbath, I'm still going to compare it to Iommi's old work, right? And what's that? That's Black Sabbath. So stop telling me to listen to it in a different way. I'm kidding, lads. I get what people are saying. It's meant to be a departure from the Sabbath material, but listen to the tracks. It really isn't. Okay, let's keep going through the track list here. This will be a quick Power of the Riff, as I'm already way over time with all this setup today. Jesus Christ, lads. On to the single then, track two, Living on the Street, It's No Stranger to Love.
Thank you.
guess that No Stranger to Love might not be so terrible to people who are into that sort of thing. Your power ballads, fucking extreme, Bon Jovi, all that stuff. It opens with this slow, kind of pseudo David Gilmour, but not as cool, solo. While the background keyboard comes so forward in the mix that it feels like we're in a goddamn 80s sci-fi porno. And the music video is just that too. Tony and his pit bull stalking some hot chick through a post-apocalyptic wasteland. The bass track on this one is actually the only sole surviving Copley track. Spitz doesn't actually play on this one, and there's nothing spectacular in Copley's bass line. Just your standard big note ring outs, very safe. Iommi said in his book, though, that the tone that Copley had was perfect and suited the song, so they didn't bother to retrack it with Spitz, but I think that the Beast could have livened up this bed track a little bit. You know, done more with all the space that's in this song. You don't have to get overly notey or anything, but you can put some fucking attack in there. Even if he was just playing the same part, it could have added interest with the way that he plays the bass in comparison. That wasn't what they were going for on this one. Hughes is brutally soft on this one, too. He finds a better pocket than Feinhold did in any of the demos, for sure, which are fucking atrocious, by the way. But let's look at some of the lyrics that he moans through here. All Glenn written, I think. The only carryover from the Feinhold demos that I hear is, "I gave you my heart, you wanted my soul," line, or whatever that is. So that tells you that Glenn at least heard the Feinhold demos, right? Going into this. Here's what he sings on the LP. "Cold as the night, lonely till dawn, cry for the light, for the love that won't come. You say that you'd never leave me alone. I gave you my heart, you cried for my soul. An angel won't come, the devil won't go. Something is wrong." Yeah, something is wrong, Glenn. These lyrics. "I just can't get away. Living on the street, I'm no stranger to love." Yeah. This one cannot fade soon enough for my taste. So the next one I dig a little more. If I'm going to pick one of the high energy numbers from this album that really works for me, it's going to be "Turn to Stone." Cool fucking riff there. And Eric Singer's intro beat is pretty damn badass as well. Very intricate part, especially when you hear the rest of his phoned in tracks on this album. Fast as shit too, right? Yeah, this one should have been the fucking opening slot instead of "In for the Kill," in my opinion. I hear a little vintage Rainbow vibes in here, like "Kill the King" or some shit. Of the bangers on this album, this one's the best. Still nowhere near "Neon Nights" or "Turn Up the Night." My man Ronnie James Dio, he would have been awesome on this one though. Slate it, but "Turn to Stone" is the first high point for me in this album. I fucking love it. Picked me up. I'm back into the tracks now. And after that banger, there's a rather haunting but brief synth interlude from Jeff Nichols that functions as a prelude to the next track. In the same vein as E5150, The Dark, Stonehenge, an interlude entitled "Sphinx, the Guardian." And like the aforementioned interludes, it ominously sets the scene with keyboards and even some wind sound effects and shit. Actually, it's kind of nice that it's on its own track for the CD crowd, so you can skip easily if you're rocking this in the car, you know? Shit, even that's old school at this point, right? Can you even get cars with CD decks in them anymore? If you were posh enough to have a CD deck in your car in the fucking 90s or something, I guess you could skip straight to "The Call," just like we're going to do right here. The Seventh Star. Something that feels a little more familiar, right? At least a little more Dio era. The title track, the centerpiece of the album, really. What's not to love about this slow-paced, bluesy, plodding number? Closes out the A-side, too. Glenn Hughes providing his strongest vocals on this one, too, in my opinion. He sounds much more comfortable, like he's finally found his pocket here. The keyboard, too, on the track that Jeff is playing, it provides an effective backdrop. It's dark, not taking over sonically like No Stranger to Love. It still works with the riff and kind of empowers it. In fact,
"The power of the riff compels me."
Yeah, this one's the power of the riff, hands down. Yeah, even with Singer's straight-ahead drum beat here, it works. Apparently depicting some saint's pilgrimage through the desert.
They're definitely channeling Dio through this one. There's a vision in the sands, rising up from the ancient past. Crying, let my spirit go, lead my burning soul to rest. Hear the sound of distant ages. It's the call of the seventh star. There's no shelter from the heat, there's no mercy from this land. Hear a thousand chanting souls, waiting judgment from God's hand. Hear the sound of distant ages, it's the call of the seventh star. Hear the sound of fallen angels, it's the call of the seventh star. This is the fucking standout on the album as far as badass lyrics, right? So I'll briefly go through side two now. First off, this one's another skipper for me. Although Ben does play it, so here, let's hear this fucking Shout at the Devil era ripoff riff. It's one of those higher energy numbers, not on the level of In for the Kill or Turn to Stone, which are much more Sabbath flavored to me. I would have scrapped this one altogether. It sounds like they're just trying to play a song like the guys on the radio are playing at the time, you know? Danger Zone is the last hair metal fix for those who are into their classic 80s metal. I guess they'll love this, but I find it dull. It's right in that She's Got the Looks to Kill wheelhouse. Like, it's got that staccato dent. You know, like every fucking song from the Sunset Strip. From the Hair Farm cash-in that was Danger Zone, you get a big fucking slab of blues. Authentic blues. Heart like a wheel. Very serviceable track. I enjoy it. Does set a nice tone, though, leading into the close of the album. And I take this over the more classic metal stuff that we've been getting so far. With Glenn's voice, too. He just kind of sinks into this one nicely. And shit gets even greater in the next two tracks, which is really one track. Angry Heart kicks fucking ass. It channels that deep purple early Whitesnake. It's just some John Lord sauce on this one. As much as this album's still very low in the rankings of all-time Black Sabbath for me, like so far, if I'm being honest, it's at the very bottom. Angry Heart and In Memory, those are great. Leaves me with a good, albeit dark and melancholic kind of feel, but Angry Heart is the hidden gem for the classic rock junkies like me. It would have been the other one that I would have liked to hear Ronnie James Dio on, too. It's really the Hammond organ-style parts that Jeff is playing here that send this track to the next level. And it rolls seamlessly into the final song, In Memory. They're pretty much the same track, actually, especially when you listen to it on vinyl. In Memory, though, I've actually heard some backstory about this little part. Like, there were claims that it was written about Iommi's father, who had recently passed away, but it was actually Jeff Nichols who penned the words about his relationship with his mother. So there you go. Some behind the lyrics meanings, finally. It's rare to find actual context behind any of these tracks. Like, what the fuck is In for the Kill about, or Danger Zone? I guess it's just about metal. And I'll be honest, the lyrics on In Memory are pretty vacant. It's more of a dreamy acoustic song. And here are the lyrics on In Memory. Jeff Nichols wrote these, apparently. No one told me the way I should feel. You left an aching heart. Lost and lonely, the feeling goes on. You were the one friend I had. You gave me so much love. Now the tears remind me you're gone. It still haunts me. There's a silence where you used to be. It still haunts me. It still haunts me. Wow. So depressing stuff. This is truly the most downer song. This is the most downer album, really, from Black Sabbath to this point. It makes the ending a little heavy-handed, too, but it really is the most interesting part of the album, to be honest, in my opinion. So the faster stuff is a little hacky on Seven Star to me. And No Stranger to Love is fucking terrible. But other than that, what does that leave? Like two, three tracks? But what a dark trip of an album this is overall. And the surrounding drama behind it just takes it to another level. So, after this record was complete, Tony delivered it to Don Arden as the first Tony Iommi solo project entitled Seven Star. But the label had other plans. They figured, hey, you own the Black Sabbath name, we own you. Let's make this a Black Sabbath album, close out our deal here, right? Don was in support of this, of course. Get all that built-in big money promotion behind the effort. He loves that idea. I mean, I get the strategy, and with the name Sabbath, you have an automatic world tour, arena size, just the name alone, the masses are going to gather, right? In their masses, at least at first, until they realize what's up. And Tony wasn't too thrilled at the idea, but After some back and forth, and I'm sure some party favors were had, they arrived at a compromise. It would be Black Sabbath featuring Tony Iommi, the seventh star. Now, apparently, news of this was broke to Glenn Hughes, who, of course, thought the whole deal was specifically not Black Sabbath, so he was pissed. I mean, he respected Black Sabbath enough and came up with them, but that was far from where he wanted to be at the time. I think Glenn was just kind of enjoying the freelance lifestyle at that time, just dipping into Gary Moore and Pat Therall albums, getting a ton of drug money and just fucking bouncing. And now, all of a sudden, he's the lead singer of fucking Black Sabbath, following up Ian Gillan. So he was kind of entrapped by the Sabs in a similar way that he was in Deep Purple, following in footsteps that he can never live up to, and forced kicking and screaming onto that lovely caravan.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the caravan.
Black Sabbath featuring Tony Iommi, featuring disgruntled Glenn Hughes, featuring Lita Ford's old rhythm section. We're geared up for the world tour here, folks. Well, North American and UK are booked to start, but who knows where this lovely caravan could end up? This could be Black Sabbath forever, right? No. It's been a while since the Born Again cycle, even. They were well into 1986 by the time the tour actually kicked off. So they didn't have the Stonehenge set anymore. They had to build a new one from scratch. And also they were deciding on how they would mix these strange new dark, bluesy, power metal songs in with the classics. Glenn wasn't any help in that regard. He didn't give a fuck about the classic material and almost out of spite didn't rehearse it much. He just wanted to do the new stuff, but they needed to keep the fans at bay as well, or else there would be riots, right? No paranoid for the billionth time. Let's burn this fucking place down. Here's a Tony quote, pre-tour, talking about the new stage set. I think this was in some guitar mag from back in 86. I didn't write down the source here, but Tony says, when asked about the Seven Star Tour and Glenn, on the left side of the stage, there will be like a city with chimneys and stuff. And then there will be this bridge that goes by the drums onto the other side of the stage that will represent the future with lasers and stuff. So we're looking at a bridge into the future, a time machine. The idea is to present Black Sabbath as entering the future. We have rehearsed for 3 months. We'll do Zero the Hero from the last album, and the rest will be classic stuff and songs from the new album. But Glenn doesn't want to do any Purple songs. I don't think he wants to even think about that period, to be honest. It's nice to see him enjoying himself now. I don't think he's cared much about doing Gary Moore and things like that. But he's in control now. He's had his problems, but that is true for all of us, really. He has had a bad period in his life when he was ill and gained weight, but he's in a new phase of his life now where he wants to focus on life and his career. It's hard to stop somebody that has made a real commitment, and he knows that we are all there for him. So that's a funny quote when you actually see what happens here. I don't know about you, but I also kind of read between the lines there. I mean, it's Tony trying to hype up the tour, but obviously Glenn is not so hot on the classic material. He says he doesn't want to do the Purple stuff, but he also doesn't mention any of the specific Black Sabbath that he's doing. Just Zero the Hero from Born Again, which is a classic in my book. But it's no secret that Glenn did not give a fuck about touring as Black Sabbath. As Tony mentioned there, they did rehearse it quite a bit leading up to it. There's even a fantastic bootleg called Turn to Glenn of one of their final rehearsals on the full stage for the first time, March 14th, which is definitely the best live recording of Glenn-fronted Sabbath quality-wise. Glenn's certainly holding back a little bit, taking the piss at times, but he does sound great. And I mean, it's just a rehearsal, too. They open up with Mob Rules and Children of the Sea, which makes me smile. And it also makes me miss Dio a little bit, actually. And the coolest thing is, when they play Zero the Hero riff into Sphinx into Seven Star, it's fucking heavy as hell. I would have loved to have seen that live. You really see the power of 80s Sabbath there. It's amazing. Despite the great rehearsals, right off the bat, the first 5 U.S. dates are canceled. It's Glenn's drug use came into play in that, I think. He's already causing problems. He had to be dragged out on stage for the actual first one that they showed up for, March 21st, 1986 in Cleveland. So look out, Cleveland, storm's coming through. Here's the set they kicked off in Cleveland with, pretty much what was rehearsed as well. Superzar tape lead-in, And they launch into those great Dio numbers, Mob Rules, followed by Children of the Sea, as mentioned. Just fucking fire to start. Then it's a new one, Danger Zone. Then Glenn Butcher's War Pigs, at least in the versions I've heard live. That song in no way suits Glenn. Then it's Angry Heart, Heart Like a Wheel, Children of the Grave, a medley of a guitar solo, and Symptom of the Universe, Sweet Leaf, Zero the Hero, as I said. That goes into the Call of the Seven Star, which is fucking awesome, and continues to be awesome. Iron Man's right after that, too. So that would be a great doomy little section. Then they shit on all that power with No Stranger to Love, followed by Neon Knights. Okay. Then they do Black Sabbath, Turn to Stone, Heaven and Hell, and naturally Paranoid to close. So it's actually pretty cool, interesting set. Should also be noted that for this tour, they had Jeff Nichols actually up on stage with him. That's a big thing too. Out of the Sabbath penalty box, as Dean Del Rey would say. Things got bad quickly though. By all the fans' accounts that I've read, it was a real fucking shit show. And if you listen to the bootlegs from those Hughes dates, it sounds atrocious. There's a little clip I want to drop in here of Tony Iommi kind of summing up the whole decline of Glenn Hughes.
Well, we took him out into the first week of the tour, first 10 days or whatever it was. Glenn was, he was just in bits. His vocals, he just couldn't sing. In fact, Jeff Nichols had to take over on vocals while Glenn was sort of standing there, really. We put a 24-hour bodyguard with him to watch him 24 hours. And this guy slept in the next room, had interjoining rooms. We put things on his door, so if he come out of his door, we'd know he's gone out, just to make sure he's okay, you know?
Yeah.
Because he did have a habit of just disappearing, and, you know, you don't know if he's going to come back.
There's even one recording where Glenn's addressing the crowd, saying, "It's a fine time to come down with a cold, isn't it?" So he was obviously embarrassed at that time, trying to cover for his shitty performance. Ultimately, the Glenn Hughes portion of the Seven Star Tour only lasted 5 dates before he was asked to leave. So here's another clip.
I got into a bit of a fracas with the production manager, and he decided to take a swing at me in the elevator going up to my room. Knocked me clean out, but he broke this bone here that went into my nasal cavity, and blood went into my throat. And by Worcester, sorry about the mic thing, in Worcester, I just, you know, we should have known at Meadowlands, people were going, "Well, Glenn can't even talk." I didn't know that I had blood in my throat, and so when Tony thought it best for a replacement to come in, then I went to see a doctor in Worcester, and they did a check on my nose and throat, and it was caked with dried blood.
And apparently Tony had a backup plan too.
The bass player I got with the band, Dave Spitz, is from New York as well, and he heard this chap, Ray Gillen, in a club. When we realised Glenn couldn't do it anymore, I said to David, "Give us that phone number." And I got the manager to call Ray and arranged to see him in New York when we were playing in New York, to see him in a hotel there. So I met him at the hotel, and everything seems to go. He seemed a nice chap, and, you know, he just seemed to know what he was talking about. And so I arranged for him the next 2 days to come along to the show. He came to the show in the evening in New York, and he came to the next 2 dates with us. Glenn went separately in a car with his bodyguard.
Was Glenn Hughes aware that this guy was hanging about?
No, he wasn't, because we sent Glenn separately in a car with the bodyguard.
So there you go. Dave Spitz actually recommends an understudy for Hughes, future Badland singer Ray Gillen, and actually a terrible person as well when you read about his demise. They had kept him in the wings, rehearsing secretly with him until the inevitable occurred with Hughes. On March 26th, Iommi officially fired Hughes. And from that night on, and through the rest of this Sabbath tour, the ninth singer was a 25-year-old Jersey boy named Ray. And Ray literally went from New Jersey bar band to Black Sabbath. But he was quite the voice, really. A shitty human for spreading disease like a dog before his death. But hell, for a vocalist, I fucking love his Badlands work with Jakey Lee. Another connection there. Ozzy's guitarist at this time, future collaborator with Gillen. I'll get deeper into Ray later on next episode, but for the rest of the tour, it's fairly uneventful. Apparently Sabbath didn't announce the change, so I think a lot of people would have been like, "Man, this Glenn Hughes guy is hot." I heard he was a fucking bloated cokehead. He didn't give a shit about the Sabbath Classics Live. They don't really change up anything at all in this tour. The War Machine just kept turning. It's a great set list, though. You get The Mob Rules, Children of the Sea, Danger Zone, War Pigs. Here's one change. Instead of the great Angry Heart, they go with just Heart Like a Wheel. I guess they could kind of stretch that out instrumentally and allow Gillan more time to kind of settle in. He delivers, though. I've heard a few fucking banging bootlegs of Ray Fronted Sabbath. It's solid stuff. And the lineup stays together, too, and they move into the studio for the next Black Sabbath record. But we'll get into all that next show. Let's park the caravan now. Okay, this is another fucking long episode. This is going to be longer than the Born Again one. Who would have thought? 7-star. I'm trying to make these tighter for you cats, too. But there's just so much going on in this era. I find it fascinating. Let me know if I'm rambling on too much. A very interesting time for the Sabs. The Call of the 7-Star. I definitely have a new level of appreciation for this record, as much as I've taken the piss out of it today. Honestly, the only tracks that I think I'll come back to on a regular basis are the title track and then the Angry Heart in Memory combo. The rest is not really my jam. Let me know what you guys think, though. Hit me up on the Twitter, @SabbathBloodyPC. That's where I'm most active. Or shoot me an email, sabbathbloodypodcast@gmail.com. If you want to go beyond that 100 or so characters that Twitter allows and really let me know how much my opinion fucking sucks. All right. See you soon, guys. Bog blast all of you.
It's a very weak sound. Everything sounds very compressed. Into my mix.